The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
We're continuing now on Whitehead and process philosophy generally. Remember this diagram now that gives you the three basic elements in the Whiteheadian system, the little blocks on the right, on the left, being the actual occasions, the circles up at the top being the ideas, the abstract objects, the values, and then God being sort of down at the lower right. We talked a little bit about the actual occasions, about how each one of them has both a physical pole and a mental pole. This is to say that each of the parts of the process is itself in process. The most basic elements of the process themselves have the have a quality of spontaneity about them, a quality of change which contributes to the whole process, that that element of spontaneity. We indicated that the physical pole, or the physical focus, the physical pole is the pole which feels or prehends the previous occasions. It's considered as being passive, essentially. The mental pole is conceived of as being active, as contributing something, as creating something new, as acting freely. And the mental pole has at least these two functions: the function of memory, that is spontaneously recalling the past occasions and making use of those past occasions in its own creative decisions. Secondly, it has the function of prehending, grasping hold of, making use of the abstract entities, the ideas, the values, for incorporation into its own life, for incorporation into its own decision-making process. Now, ideas are not considered to be actual. They are abstract in themselves, like the idea of goodness, the idea of rightness, and so on. These are abstract. They don't have any reality until they are brought into the actions of actual occasions. It's the choice of the mental pole of the actual occasion that makes the ideas actual, that makes them concrete, that brings them into the world so that they can actually play a role. It's the choice of now human beings are groups of actual occasions. You see, human beings are clusters of actual occasions. And so you can see the kind of Kantian thrust behind that. We choose certain values to bring to bear on our experience, and all of the abstract structure of our experience results from those free choices that we make. Now, let's talk a little bit about God and the role that God plays in all of this. First of all, God, for Whitehead, answers the question, why is there anything at all? Why is there anything at all? Now, God is not the creator in the Christian sense, because he's not the origin of the, I'll talk a little bit more about that later. He's not the creator in the Christian sense. In Whitehead's early writings, God is really a kind of principle within the world. In Whitehead's earlier writings, God is seen to be the ground of rationality. the ground of rationality, the source of the spontaneous creativity by which the actual occasions make their choices. God is the supreme fount of that rationality. And since God is the basis of rationality, he is himself irrational. He is himself contingent. Now, we've seen that. That sounds strange, but we've heard that argument before in our discussion. That's we heard that argument in connection with Plotinus, remember? Plotinus said that the most basic principle of all things cannot be red because it's the principle of redness, cannot be good because it's the principle of goodness, cannot be rational because it's the principle of rationality, and so on and so forth. Whitehead then characterizes God, since he is the source of rationality, as himself not rational in character, because to be rational in character is to be subordinate to some principle of rationality beyond yourself. So God does not have that principle, and Whitehead then, in his early writings at least, describes God as the principle of irrationality, of contingency, and in that sense almost equivalent in some ways with creativity. Now, in Whitehead's later writings, God becomes a little bit more concrete than that. God becomes an actual entity which includes all of the other entities in the world, all right? He includes within his own being all the actual occasions. The whole flow of reality, the whole process is included in God. But God goes somewhere somewhat beyond that process. And Charles Hartshorne has dreamed up a name for that. The name is one that I think you've run into before in your reading, panentheism. Panentheism. Pantheism is the idea that God is all and all is God. Panentheism, literally, all is in God. Everything is in God, but God goes beyond the world. You can say that everything in this world is divine, but this world is not all there is to God. God goes somewhat beyond the world as we know it, panentheism. So in that sense, you wouldn't want to say then that God is the creator of the world in the Christian sense, but you can see why Whitehead would say that God is the ground of all things. You can see why he would say that God answers the question why there is anything at all. Although perhaps Whitehead's answer is merely a restating of the question. The second question that's answered by the concept of God is the question of why there should be these particular occasions. Why the process should be as it is, why this particular set of occasions should exist rather than others. Now, God is responsible for choosing what Whitehead calls the initial aim of each actual occasion. Perhaps this is oversimplifying, but I think you may be helped if you see this initial aim as roughly congruent with the physical pole. That is to say, God ordains the actual occasion insofar as it can be determined, all right? Insofar as it is a function of its past, insofar as it is a function of its environment. You can say that it's that God has brought it about, because after all, God is the environment. God is the totality and more. So you can say that then God has determined the physical pole. God has determined the initial aim. But God does not determine the creative function. You might put it this way, that God does not determine the mental pole. The actual occasions are independent of God so far as their creativity is concerned. And so here you have Whitehead's equivalent of the concept of free will. Each actual occasion is utterly free so far as determination by God is concerned. It chooses its ideas, it chooses the past events to which it will relate itself, and thereby makes its own decisions. The third function of God in the Whitehead system is to give order to the world of ideas. God limits, to some degree, the values which are possible within the world, those values which may possibly be chosen by the occasions. So God, determines the order of those, and he limits the number of them that can be brought into any actual decision-making process. So that God then has some relationship to the world of ideas. He also has some relationship to the actual occasions. You can't say that he creates the ideas because the ideas aren't actual until they're brought into the flow of history. Well, you can think about it in personal terms if you want, because the actually persons are collections of occasions. So. You can think of it in terms of a person making choices. Is this good or is it bad? Well, you choose to do something good, so you bring goodness into the flow of history at that point. You choose to actualize goodness. Or you want to decide whether to, you're making something and you want to know whether to make it good or green or blue. Well, you think about that for a while, and you freely choose to make it green, and so you bring greenness into the flow of history at that point. Now, something analogous evidently takes place even in the minutest portions of history, and that's what we're talking about when we talk about actual occasions, all right? Okay, what are we doing? Okay, yes, God chooses the initial aim, not the creative function of the occasions. He orders the ideas. And God has two aspects, according to Whitehead. He has a primordial aspect and he has a consequent aspect. These are also called natures. God has a primordial nature and God has a consequent nature. The primordial nature goes like this. I'll explain that other terminology in a minute. The primordial nature goes like this. In any possible world, there must be a God that has certain functions. In any world that you can conceive of, according to Whitehead, there must be a God who chooses the initial aim of the actual occasions, who orders the ideas, who performs these functions that we've discussed here today. Whitehead cannot conceive of any world that has any different structure from this. Now, this is a form of the ontological argument in a way. Whitehead is saying that a certain kind of God must exist if anything exists. Even in order to think meaningfully about anything, you must presuppose some kind of God. And that kind of God that you presuppose must have these qualities. Now, these are qualities that you can ascribe to God apart from any experience. You don't need to know anything about your own particular world in order to come to these conclusions. You simply consider the concept of anything, any possible world, and you must deduce from that consideration that there really is a God of this kind. Now, the primordial nature of God consists of those attributes that apply to him in any possible world, okay? The primordial nature consists in those attributes which must necessarily pertain to him just by virtue of his being God. And whatever kind of world there would be a God who has those attributes, who has that kind of nature. This is, in a sense, an a priori judgment. All of these attributes are arrived at a priori, if you will. Now, the consequent nature of God has to do with specific attributes that he picks up through his interaction with this world. All right? In the actual world in which we live, God is a function of the actual occasions. You see, the actual occasions make free choices. They make free decisions. They're not determined by God, but their free decisions actually affect the nature of God. Because God is made up of those actual occasions and, of course, more. So what those free minds decide is going to affect the nature of God. It's going to modify the nature of God. And you can't predict how that's going to work. You can't predict how the nature of God is going to change from moment to moment, how it's going to develop from moment to moment. You can't argue a priori that God must have the properties which he has in our particular world. You have to look at the world and see. You have to examine the course of history that's governed by the free choices of rational agents and see what God is like. And then you discover what God's consequent nature is. God's consequent nature is that nature which is responding to the events of the world. It's that it's God's nature as it's affected by the course of history, as it's changed by the course of history, as it develops in interaction with, in response to the course of history. So you have an interesting variation on the theme of necessity and freedom here. God is an absolutely necessary being. God must exist no matter what world you have. You can't conceive of a world without him. And yet, nevertheless, he is in process. He's dependent upon the world. He's responsive to the world. He's changing all the time, and he's changing in interaction with the world. So you can talk, in a sense, about God's transcendence and God's immanence, if you want to use those terms. You can talk about God's absoluteness and his involvement with the created world. Now let me give you a little bit of Charles Hartshorne's terminology, because you'll be running into this perhaps in some of your theological reading. Hartshorne takes the same contrast that we found in Whitehead between the primordial and the consequent natures of God. And Hartshorne uses somewhat different terminology to describe it. He distinguishes between absolute perfection and relative perfection, two different kinds of perfection in God, and sometimes he abbreviates it. So if you're reading Hartshorne, you'll find him talking about a perfection, that's absolute perfection, and our perfection, which is relative perfection. Now, the a perfection, the absolute perfection, comes in when he's talking about the ontological argument. Again, Hartshorne accepts the ontological argument. He argues that you can, a priori, apart from any conceivable experience, affirm God as the necessary being. The proof does not depend on any particular experience you've had. It will work in any conceivable world. This God that you prove through the ontological argument is that than which no greater can be conceived. He's that God whom you regard as absolutely perfect. Hartshorne argues in the tradition that even if you hold that all is relative, even if you try your best to deny all absolutes and you say all is relative, nevertheless you have to hang on for dear life to relativity, don't you? You have to make an exception of relativity. You have to say that relativity itself is absolute. You have to say that all is relative except for relativity. So there must be some absolute. Any conceivable universe, he argues, will include an absolute, will include a being whose existence can be proved a priori, which is self-sufficient, which is necessary, which is superior to all. But, says Hartshorne, this perfection, this absolute perfection, is entirely abstract. It has no content to it. It has no concreteness to it, except for the fact that it is an absoluteness, except for the fact that it is a priori provable, that there is something which does not change, something which is necessary to the creation. So Hartshorne argues this kind of absoluteness cannot be the whole story. If you're going to get any content into your doctrine of God, there must be another way to go about doing it. You can't get all of that content out of the ontological argument. You can't get it out of any process of describing necessary existence. So there's a different kind of perfection also that God possesses, and Hartshorne calls this relative perfection or our perfection. That is to say, in any universe, whatever universe you're thinking of, God will be more perfect than anything else. But in our universe, he is specifically more perfect than the things in our universe. In our universe, he's more perfect than trees and chairs and tables and people. Those are the specific things that he's more perfect than. And so if you're going to find out what he is more perfect than, you have to look at the world. You have to look at the particular world in which we live. And then you discover the attributes of God. You discover that you discover these relative attributes of God. You discover that God is more perfect than trees. You discover that God is more perfect than the smartest person in the class. You discover that God is more perfect than the most powerful political ruler. You discover all of these things by looking at the world. So God's perfections, then, are determined by the beings in the universe. God's perfections are discovered through a survey of the universe, and not only are they discovered through a survey of the universe, they're actually caused by the universe. This is the way of eminence taken to, pushed in a very self-conscious direction and pushed in a very self-consciously unbiblical direction. We criticized Thomas Aquinas some time ago for his use of the way of eminence, where you simply look at the things in the world and you reason that God must have the highest degree of all perfections that you observe in the world. And we said that there was a certain ambiguity in that procedure, that if you don't do that with biblical presuppositions, you're going to come up with a God who is simply an extension of what you have in the world. Well, this is exactly what's happened so far as in Hartshorne's thought, and it happens very specifically and very self-consciously. That's what Hartshorne wants. Hartshorne wants a God who includes all the perfections in this world and goes somewhat beyond them. That's what he's after. Now, how does God become more perfect than all the things in this world? Well, he becomes more perfect by responding to events. Now, if there were no human beings in the world, God could not surpass them in justice because there would be nobody to surpass. God responds to the things that there are in the world. Since there are human beings in the world, God knows about them and God is involved with them and so on, and in the course of that involvement, he surpasses them in all the qualities that they have. He surpasses them in justice. At any moment, God surpasses all the perfections that are held by anyone in the universe. So the fact that men are just causes God to surpass us in justice. Um, God continues to grow then. He continues to develop. As men grow in their justice and in their knowledge, God also grows. Now, at any given moment, of course, God surpasses all the wisdom in the world, all the justice, all the perfections, but God also continually surpasses himself as human beings continually surpass themselves, or as the creation surpasses itself. God grows, he develops in response to the developments in the world. Now, you might say, isn't that very responsiveness an imperfection? Isn't it imperfect if you have a God who is so dependent on his creatures as this God is? And that certainly would be the response of a biblical Christian, I think, to find in that a kind of imperfection. Is Whitehead's God, is Hartshorne's God really perfect? And the answer would seem to be no. By the way, you see, you can tell that the whole idea of perfection itself is very much dependent on your presuppositions. What is perfection? What is imperfection? Those are value judgments, and your value judgments are going to be profoundly influenced by your religious assumptions about the world. And we, a biblical Christian will have all kinds of problems in recognizing as perfections the things that Hartshorne finds as perfections. But Hartshorne tries to defend himself at this point too. Hartshorne argues that responsiveness in God is a perfection. Responsiveness in God is a perfection. And he argues for that not only on philosophical grounds, but also on religious grounds. Here's some of his argumentation. Hartshorne argues, look, in our world, the most perfect beings are the most responsive, right? The most perfect beings are the ones that can adapt themselves most perfectly to their environments. Here's a little trace of evolutionary theory coming through. If I hit a rock, it doesn't hit me back. It just sits there. Well, that's an imperfection. It hasn't reached the point where it can respond adequately to me. If I hit a dog, the dog bites me. Well, we consider the dog as a little higher on the scale of being. A dog is a little better. A dog is a little more perfect because it's capable of responding. It's capable of interacting with its environment. Now, the human mind, says Hartshorne, is considered to be the pinnacle of reality because precisely it's the most adaptable thing that you can imagine. The human mind is that which is, well, in a special technical sense that I don't have time to get into, it's the most relative of all things. Well, maybe you can see why he uses that word. The human mind is the most relative of all things that we are aware of in our experience. It responds to things in its environment. It changes. Everything that happens, causes some modification, causes some change in the mind so that the mind can respond freely to it. The essence of the mind is to respond intelligibly to reality. The essence of man is to react to his world. So, says Hartshorne, just push the scale up another step. God, on this view of perfection, must be the most relative of all beings. God must be the most responsive. God must be the one who is most dependent upon his environment in a certain way. God is the only being who is internally related. Maybe some of you will be helped by that terminology, is internally related to all other things in the universe. God is the only being who responds to every conceivable circumstance and responds in such a way as to triumph, all right? God is the only one who responds to every event that takes place in the universe and uses all of those events in a creative way to increase his own perfection. And, of course, even human beings can't do that. And so Hartshorne argues then that relativity is a perfection, that responsiveness is a perfection. Furthermore, he argues that this is exactly what the religions want. He uses religious, theological arguments. This is what all the religions want. They want a God who responds, right? They want a God who is immanent in the world. They want a God who can act in the world in response to situations that crop up. They want a God who answers prayer. And for Hartshorne, answering prayer is precisely responding, changing your mind, changing your plans in response to something that happens. God is planning to do one thing. Somebody prays. The plans are changed. And unless you have that kind of structure, says Hartshorne, you can't have any concept of prayer at all. Hartshorne then argues that both on philosophical grounds and on religious grounds, you have to accept responsiveness as Van Til would say, correlativism, as a perfection of God. So to both Hartshorne and Whitehead, God is a God in process. Although God is a priori conceivable apart from any universe, that a priori perfection is purely abstract, and the content of it is defined by the world. As the world progresses, as the world changes, God reacts to it, growing more and more perfect in relation to the world and in relation to his own previous states, in relation to his own previous nature. Well, can we see the dialectic of rationalism and irrationalism coming in here? I think we can see it, and we can see it with a vengeance. We can see the something very much like the Greek form-matter scheme here. We can see something rather similar to Kant's dialectic. A great many of these themes ought to be impressing you. God is defined as absolute, but it's an absoluteness which has as little content as possible, very much like Aristotle's pure form, very much like the forms of Plato, very much like the noumenal world of Kant, which has no structure, no character to it. On the other hand, you have the you want to say that God does have some content. You do want to say that he has more than just abstract characteristics. And when you bring in something more than that, when you try to make him more than abstract, you make him relative to the creation. You make him essentially another factor in the creation, who is somewhat larger than the creation, but only somewhat larger, and thus unable to perform the kinds of jobs that Hartshorne wants to give to him. This is a God who is just, as Van Til likes to say, correlative to the world. That is to say, he needs us as much as we need him. And so he and we are in this together. He can have no certain knowledge of the future. He can give no sure and certain hope for salvation. He, in a sense, is limited by the material with which he is working, and he is, in fact, dependent upon our free decisions as to what final shape the universe will take. Of course, even if it degenerates into a chaos, even if it becomes a nothing, even if it becomes a living hell, we are assured by Whitehead that God will still surpass it. But that gives us scant comfort, because the process of the world is really quite completely open. Well, you have a rationalistic emphasis, the emphasis upon the ontological argument, the emphasis on being able to deduce in any possible world what God will be like, the emphasis on our ability to deduce God's attributes from a consideration of the character of the world. On the other hand, you have the irrationalistic side and the concept of freedom, and the concept of the mental pull, which not even God is capable of determining, which responds with total independence from the past, from God himself, from all considerations, independent from the ideas as well. So that what you have there is an element of pure chance entering into the system, and as we've said before, the element of chance compromises the rationalistic side, and the rationalistic side compromises the element of pure chance, and the two of them just can't be made to work together. All right, this is the brings to a conclusion the discussion of philosophy. A lot more, of course, could be said, but we just don't have time to do any more than we've done so far. Now, I had actually planned for a great many additional lectures in this course, that we would have a unit on contemporary theology, that we'd have a unit on modern general culture, that we'd have a unit on contemporary apologetics or apologetics since Aquinas, and then we'd have a unit on the problems of apologetics. Well, we have four sessions left in the course, and I don't think we're going to get to all those things. Doesn't bother me too much, really, because you've had you've done quite a bit of reading, and I'm very pleased, really, with what you're learning from your reading. This is about the first year that I've taught at Westminster that I think people have actually read things, that people have actually learned from readings rather than merely lectures, and I'm glad to see that on your exams, and I'm glad to see that in your discussion groups when I come around and visit. So you are, of course, you've read Harvey Kahn's Contemporary World Theology, and you have, well, it's a layman's introduction, it's a popular introduction, but what can you do in a course like this beyond giving a popular introduction? So I don't think that you're really deprived from having been limited to that. I'm not sure that I would be able to go much beyond that if I were lecturing on modern theologians. General culture, well, you've heard a lecture by Harvey on film, and you've heard a lecture, some of you at least heard a lecture by Donald Drew on literature, and maybe we'll get to say a few things more, but I'm not sure about that. I'm not, my own field, of course, is philosophy and theology anyway, and I sort of fumble my way around when I get outside that type of area. Let's see, the other units we are going to do, the history of apologetics. Well, the thing is that not much has happened since Aquinas in the history of apologetics. I do want to summarize a few developments that are interesting in the apologists since Aquinas, but I won't. I don't think you're too badly off if you don't have all of that. Of course, Van Til's discussions about Buswell and Clark and so on. Really, there aren't too many people around today who say much that Buswell and Clark don't say. And then the problems of apologetics. We have discussed in this course the proofs for the existence of God. We've discussed the problem of evil under Unit 2. Remember, I talked about a scriptural approach to the problem of evil. And we've discussed the question of verification and falsification in the connection with the language analyst philosophers. And those are basically the three problems that are most commonly discussed in apologetic circles. Of course, there are quite a few more. I've given you a kind of summary of them on your outline, on the last page of your outline for Christianity and the Great Debate, so you might get an idea of some of the problems that need to be discussed. But now, I guess for the next sessions, I'll sort of summarize the material that I had left for you, or that I might have organized had we had more time. And then probably that won't take more than the next couple of sessions, and then we can have quite a bit of time for general discussion after that. So bring in questions that have been bothering you, and we'll try to go over some of them. All right, just to summarize a few thoughts on theology since Kant. I just want to show you here how this general dialectic of rationalism and irrationalism appears in theologians as well as philosophers, because this sort of thing is this type of thinking that we've seen in the Kantian and post-Kantian modern philosophy has profoundly influenced contemporary theology. And really, you're up against the same problems in contemporary theology that you're up against in contemporary philosophy. In Kant, you recall, there is no room for either general or special revelation in the traditional sense. Kant rejects all the proofs for the existence of God, so you can't learn about God through general revelation. You can't learn about God through nature. Kant also rejects the idea of God speaking authoritatively in the phenomenal world. Remember, we said that for Kant, if God does try to speak to us in the phenomenal world, we must judge that speaking according to the categories of our own reason. We must make sure that that water fits into the ice cube trays. We must make sure that it fits the structure of our own mind. So there's no possibility, then, of God's word serving as an absolute authority within the phenomenal world. Here we've eliminated special revelation. Nevertheless, there is, in Kant's system, much talk about God. He does argue that we must presuppose God in various aspects of our lives. Particularly, we must presuppose God in order to carry on the moral life, in order to make our moral decisions rightly, and also to develop a proper methodology in science. In these areas, we must act as if God exists. Now, Kant's God, therefore, is a creation of the human rational imagination. God is postulated. God is assumed in order to meet certain rational and moral needs that we have. This is a God who is totally relative, then, to the universe and very far from the sovereign God of Scripture. Now, this leads, of course, to a reconstruction of all the Christian doctrines, a reconstruction of all the doctrines of the Bible. Harvey Kahn gives you this quotation from Kant's book, Religion Within the Limits of Reason Alone. The quotation goes like this: true religion is to consist not in the knowledge or considering of what God does or has done for our salvation, but in what we must do to become worthy of it. And of its necessity, every man can become wholly certain without any scriptural learning whatever. So you see, the whole gospel here is perverted. Instead of biblical authority, you have the authority of human reason. Instead of God being the sovereign creator of all things, we find that God is the creation of man's imagination. Instead of man being created to the glory of God, to glorify God and enjoy Him forever, we find that God is created in order to meet the demands of man's reason and man's moral sense. Salvation is not by grace through faith, but salvation is wholly a matter of man's righteousness, what man may do to become worthy of salvation, since man is autonomous throughout this system. And a product, and salvation is a product of man's perfectly free initiatives, because man, of course, is to regard himself as totally free with regard to his moral decisions. Nevertheless, although all of the Christian doctrines then, the doctrine of revelation, the doctrine of God, the doctrine of salvation, although all of these doctrines are reversed in Kant's system, nevertheless, in Kant's thought, there are some resources for speaking biblically. There are resources for speaking biblically. The noumenal world of Kant gives you lots of room, if that's what you want, gives you lots of room for talking about transcendence, lots of room for talking about mystery, because after all, the noumenal world is mysterious. It's not only mysterious, it's unknowable. It's the realm of all of these things, such as God, freedom, and immortality, which pose mysteries for man, which man is incapable of knowing, of understanding through his reason. So far as the phenomenal world is concerned, there are resources there for speaking about God's historicity, for speaking about the involvement between God and man, for speaking about man in the image of God, for speaking about the union between God and man, and if you want, speaking of the union between God and man in Christ. Now, Kant himself does not make use of all these resources, but he does give us these resources, and later theologians have made use of them. you can think of the of the square in these terms, but in Kant, God is in the noumenal world. God is wholly transcendent in the sense of being wholly beyond us, wholly outside of our experience, wholly beyond the phenomenal world, the world in which we live, and therefore totally mysterious and totally unknowable. That would be transcendence within a general Kantian framework. Immanence of God, then, would be to say that when God does get involved with the phenomenal world, God takes on the form of the phenomena. God submits himself to the categories of our mind. God becomes an object like other objects within the world. God, in fact, becomes indistinguishable from the experience that we have in the phenomenal world. Well, what more could you want? You have a God who's transcendent and you have a God who's immanent. You have a God who's above us, and yet you have a God who dwells with us, don't you? You have a God who's above us, and yet you have a God who identifies himself with us. Isn't that the essence of the covenant? Isn't it the idea that God is the Lord, God is above all things, and yet he commits himself in solidarity to be a God of a particular people, to be with them, to fulfill promises to them, and so on and so forth. Well, you can talk about all of those things if you want to within a Kantian framework. And so you see the significance of the horizontal lines on that square. You can use all the biblical language. There are resources in the Kantian scheme for using all the biblical language, and yet using it to express a scheme which is really totally opposite to the biblical message of salvation. Well, as I mentioned, Kant himself does not use all of these resources that he's given to later theologians, but others have. One is Friedrich Schleiermacher, a very important figure who's not mentioned in Kant's book, but I think you all ought to know his name. Friedrich Schleiermacher, an immediate successor to, he lived a younger contemporary of Kant, died some years after Kant died. Schleiermacher, often called the father of modern theology, and he takes a basically Kantian scheme and he presents the whole of Christian theology in terms of that scheme. First of all, for Schleiermacher, religion is a very important category. Schleiermacher does not want to reduce religion to morality the way Immanuel Kant did. Schleiermacher wants rather to notice the distinctiveness of religion, to see that religion is something very different from other kinds of activity in man's life. Religion is an experience which all people have. It's a distinctive experience, different from other kinds of experience. It's an experience which is shared by many religions, of which Christianity is the highest form. This experience can be characterized by the German term Gefühl, which is sometimes translated simply feeling. Others try to be a bit more sophisticated and translate it as intuition. I'll let the scholars debate as to which translation is the most appropriate. It doesn't make too much difference for our purposes. Schleiermacher further explains that feeling by saying that it consists of an awareness, a feeling, or an intuition or an awareness of our absolute dependence, of absolute dependence, a feeling of absolute dependence. Now, God in Schleiermacher's system, and this is a direct quote from Schleiermacher's book, The Christian Faith, page 17, God, according to Schleiermacher, in the first instance, signifies for us simply that which is the co-determinant of that feeling. Simply that which is the co-determinant of that feeling. In other words, all of us who are religious feel absolutely dependent. Now, what is God? Well, God is just a name we give to the object of that dependence. What are you dependent on? Well, different people would characterize it in different ways. You know, a Hindu would characterize it in one way, a Christian another, a Jew in another. But you can simply call it God. No matter how you would positively characterize it, the term God is a good word to use to describe the whatever you feel yourself to be absolutely dependent on. The scriptures arise out of the Christian religion, says Schleiermacher. That is to say, scriptures are a human attempt to explain, to articulate, to set forth the implications of this feeling. And of course, there are many scriptures that do this. The scriptures of all religions attempt to articulate, to set forth in words, to reflect upon, to apply, to consider that feeling of absolute dependence. And there's one particular tradition that has produced the Bible in its reflections, in its considerations of the feeling of absolute dependence. So the Bible then is a purely human book. It's a product of human reflection. It's a product of human labors. Now, Christianity is the religion in which the sense of dependence is defined by faith in Jesus Christ as Savior. All right, some religions define the sense of dependence by talking about nirvana, talking about Brahma, talking about Allah. Christianity defines the sense of absolute dependence in terms of Jesus Christ as Savior. This is a kind of scheme that Christians use to define the nature of the feeling of absolute dependence. Now, Schleiermacher thinks that this is the most adequate way of doing it, that this is the highest way of doing it, but he doesn't feel that this is absolutely true as over against all of the other formulations that could be presented. Well, more on this later.